Hello, and welcome to episode 200 of Endeavors. And it's a 3-for-1 today. You'll be hearing from local Toronto punk bands, The Exploders, as well as Happy Hour Choir, and from the film Luba, I speak with director Kaylee Wilson and star Brianna D'Aguano. That's all coming up on Endeavors. Indecision keeps me up now. Need another place to mind my mind. Give a little bit of God to sin. Keeping safe is keeping you away. The Exploders are a Toronto-based punk band that have existed in various forms over the years. In 2017, they released an album called The Full Ghetto Sessions, many of whose songs originated in 1999 in a recording session in Detroit, Michigan. I had a chance to speak with two of the band's members, guitarist Classy Craig Daniels and bass player Eric Duell, about how this album came to be, the long road that led to it. They've done a couple other projects in between. Their favorite memories of recording in Detroit, which is, in my opinion, undervalued for its artistic diversity, and what they think of the punk music scene today. So this is Craig Daniels and Eric Duell from the band The Exploders.
Oh yeah, not a
I'm here with Craig and Eric from The Exploders. Hello, hey. Gentlemen. Hey. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm good. You know, I was doing some research before this interview, and it was a little bit difficult because there's another band in Australia that has the same name. Are you aware of these imposters?
Yes. Yep. Yeah, so we're going to take them out. Yep.
Have you heard their music? What do you think?
I listened to it a bit. It was like, I think it's just rock or something. I don't know.
Yeah,
it's fine. Are they still even going? They may have beat them.
Yeah, well, so according to the Wikipedia, they formed in 2005, I think. And if I was on iTunes, their last album came out like 5 years ago, maybe, I want to say, something like that.
Okay.
Yeah, anyway. They were going for it, right? They were like signed and
yeah,
in Europe.
Yeah,
and all
some
that kind of stuff. So, that's cool.
Speaking of records, I go on to the Bandcamp, and it's I think it's called the Complete Ghetto Sessions.
Yeah.
Which I understand was released in 2017, but I think was recorded years before.
In like 99.
Yeah.
We formed, was it 98-ish?
Yep. 90, yeah. And then, fall of 98, right?
And then by the following, maybe fall almost, I think we went down to Detroit, and at the time, this guy Jim Diamond had a really good studio, Ghetto Recorders, that was doing like a lot of stuff on Crypt Records. And he would, when we recorded there, he was talking about, there's this band, the White Stripes, that just started, and oh man, they're trouble. They're arguing, they used to be a couple, but now they broke up, and she's not the best drummer, and he's on her case, and they fight a lot. So it was in an old chicken poultry processing plant, and in behind, was it the Fox Theater?
Yep.
On Woodward in Detroit, like right off the main street, but you go in, but anyway, it's a really cool facility, 2-inch tape, the guy's great.
It's right around the corner from, sorry not to interrupt, the new baseball stadium.
Yeah, wow. The Tiger Stadium.
Yeah.
Right.
Oh yeah, okay.
One, not the old
it's
one.
Basically not
the
American
Tiger Stadium is. Yeah, so we went down there and we didn't know what we were doing, like, let's record everything we think we have ready. And we're like, is it an album? Is it not? And then we looked around and we're like, oh, let's record it. Let's release it as 7 inches. So the first two are 7 inches that we put out. That's songs from there. And then by the time those came out, we're like, I don't know, maybe we can do better. Like, you start second guessing. You're like, that stuff's cool, but maybe we can re-record some of them and take another shot at them. And then time passes and a lot of things happen. There's different lineups of the band. We break up, we come back at it, and I listen to that stuff for the whole thing for the first time in ages. I'm like, I was out of my mind. That stuff's great. There's nothing wrong with it. The sounds on it are incredible. Yeah, we just had giant amps cranked up. There was no baffling, I think, whatsoever.
And it was summer and it was really hot.
Okay, yeah, it was summer, that's right. Yeah, our drummer was getting a bit warm. We did the old tape the headphones to his head because they were sliding off. And so that's the history of that stuff. And and we still have, even tonight, I have the last of the 7 inches. We have a few copies still of the things that were cut there. And, you know, I was in Montreal and DJ threw on one of our 7 inches, the What's What and Who's Who, which was from that Ghetto Recorder stuff at a bar at La Bar Ritz in Montreal. And man, it stood up. Like, he played that and then he played Emil and the Sniffers right after. And I'm like, oh man, sonically. And it's just, he did a great job. He's a really good engineer.
Was it weird to go back and listen to these songs that you recorded, you know, 15, 16, 17 years ago?
Yeah, well, some of them I don't really remember.
They're all pretty catchy tunes, though, so they're really easy to get into.
Yeah.
And easy to remember. The melodies come back and the lyrics come back.
Yeah, once you hear them, like, fun. It was weird in a good way. I'm like, oh. I mean, everybody's really critical of their own stuff, but I was really like, wow.
Not to be too wordy, whatever, but Craig's done a lot of work. He's got a lot of projects on the go all the time, so he's got a lot of body in his library, so there's a lot of stuff that he can pick and choose from, so he can go back and go, oh yeah, I did work on that stuff, and then it's, when you check it out again, you're like, oh wow, it stood up, so.
I think I've learned to be a bit easier on myself once I went back and listened to that, because I'm like, oh, we gotta relax a little, maybe.
Just on that note, you know, as you get older and more experienced as a band, does the notion of, you know, self-criticism change at all?
I think you sort of inherently know when things are working or not a lot quicker, maybe.
I think as musicians, we get together in a room and put something together in 5 minutes. We're just that comfortable with one another, I guess.
Newer songs, like a couple new songs we were doing tonight, didn't take very long to get together. You're quicker.
You just know each other's strengths and weaknesses and what works and what doesn't work. So that kind of stuff is matured. And easier, I guess, to figure out when you show up to write new material or whatever. And it never is not fun, though.
Yeah.
Or nice.
Yeah, it's cool.
Punk songs are notorious for being really fast and energetic and under 2 minutes, for the most part. Yeah. So how would you describe then the song writing process as punk musicians?
I try and like a song like Electric Power is almost just supposed to be like a little shock. And it's just here and it's gone. Like, that's like, is it a minute and a half? It's not even. And then other ones, like even tonight, like more from the second record, Hot and Dirty was like, you know, more like a Stooges jam. So it was like a bit longer. So I kind of look at the feeling of the song and then just try and, or maybe even if there's a title already, then I try and put that into a. But mainly, especially with this project, it's like the main focus is to kick ass, kind of. Like, it started off as like, when I listen to some of the stuff back, like there's almost a, like, in not even really knowing the Killed by Death punk series, some of our influences and then mixing things, some of this, like the way we ended up and with Simon singing, it reminds me of some of that kind of like, that weird in-between punk kind of stuff, and that kind of inadvertently happened. And then later on, we might have like tried to mine a bit more, like, oh, like a bit of Motorhead-ish energy or something. So there's usually an idea behind, like, some idea of what it's shooting for, and hybridizing sounds before.
Yeah.
And then, of course, yeah, then when, especially early on, like, his bass sound made it sound completely different, and then Simon's voice. So then it's like everything takes a life of its own.
You mentioned cutting and producing the record in Detroit, which I think is a city that's flies under the radar in terms of its musical diversity. You mentioned the White Stripes, of course, Eminem, Aretha.
Yep.
Just getting, you know, to make a record in that type of culture, you know, what were there any moments that really sunk in for you? Like,
yeah.
Look at all the people that came through this city.
And it's got nothing to do with the music. We all finished a long day in the studio and actually got chased by a pack of wild dogs back to the guy's house. We were yeah. saying, yeah, that was pretty fucking crazy. That was yeah, like,
chowdown.
That was literally eating yeah. like by wild dogs. It was, because back then, Detroit had not had the low point that it hit in 2008. It
yeah,
was
after
still
the yeah
going down, and there were yeah. like blocks and blocks and blocks of city blocks that were just decimated from the riots in the 60s and 70s that never came back. Yeah. It has an edge, but it also that kind those kinds of cities in the States, especially with their economy, you get the best of the art world because of the cheapness of the yeah. cost of living, right? So it's a dichotomy that's.
And all the people I met down there, like, through the 90s, and, like, you go to their house, and they've got, like, they've really embraced the history of the place, and, yeah. like, so even, you know, and there was magazines like Motor Booty, and, like, of course, being, like, getting into Stooges and Funkadelic and stuff, and then you go to these, like, oh, it's, like, a new friend from a band down there, and they've got, like, a giant cutout of, like, George Clinton yeah. from the Motor Booty Affair album, and it's like, oh, that's cool, and I'm like, oh, if you think that's cool, check this thing, and, like,
right.
all that stuff. It was really easy for them to be archaeologists in their own town, because I think all that stuff was just abandoned almost.
Yeah. Sad.
So that was kind of the experience for me of, like, being down there. It's like, and they talk about, at that time, like, Dan, I won't say who was saying it, but they're like, oh, Ron Ashton from the Stooges, oh, he just drinks beer in his garage all day, and someone convinced him to be in a bad monster movie with, like... And we go visit him. I don't know. He doesn't really do much. And then that's before the Stooges reuniting and stuff. But it's like, it was almost like, yeah, when you say flying under the radar, it was like for a period of time, it was like all this stuff was like, oh, whatever, you know. And then people like, not that we're responsible, but at the million bands like us, and then their band, you know, White Stripes coming out and... reminding people, okay, this is where a lot of stuff started. And
plus the Gorys, you know, and Demolition Doll Rods, all
yeah,
those guys.
And Gory's coming back to play.
And all their friends have bands. And,
yeah.
You know,
yeah, so and yeah, so it's like, I just love the vibe there. It's a hard thing to describe, but yeah. It's a fun town.
It strikes me that no matter what city you go, and there's always a small but very tight-knit punk community. Why do you think that scene is so much more close-knit than perhaps, you know, the country, you know, the country music fans or the rock fans or the jazz fans?
Well, I would say probably because the artwork's a lot more aggressive and the people that are attracted to it, they have to come down a long pipe hole to get to that point. And some of the stuff's pretty dark.
Yeah.
You know, some of it's pretty not politically correct. I don't know.
Yeah, that's, you know. It's the places you gather. Like, there might be only a few specialty bars that really feature the stuff, so you're running into the same people. And
like this place.
Yeah.
You know?
So it just, yeah, it kind of keeps it... there's an inherent tightness to it, you know? People come and go, but I think there's, like... For instance, even the Plastic Heads tomorrow night, like, oh, that's John Sharon. Oh, I've been doing gigs with that guy on and off for, you know, like 20 years or something. Yeah, so it's kind of, It just kind of happens, yeah. I guess people get weeded out. Maybe that's, yeah. You know, like the Black Flag record, the process of weeding out, maybe. I don't know.
With, you know, with this sort of, I guess, culture going around where they say that, you know, the younger generations are mad at the older generations, and even though the boomers and the Gen Xers sort of invented punk, what do you make of all that, and what would you say to any sort of young and up and coming punk bands today?
I think historically any generations rebelled against
them.
but kids are always going to tell you to fuck off, but
then I think you realize maybe it's a little. When I think of myself, when I was first getting into rock and punk, and like, I'd go, oh, that band. I was telling a story the other night about Forgotten Rebels, kind of not quite getting booed off stage, but getting quite heckled at a Cramp show in the 80s. But at that little brief period of time when hardcore was really popular, they're more 77 style, and the way he was dressed was very, like, kind of a glance. Anyway. People were yelling, "Yeah, Rod Stewart, get off the stage!" And like, but it was just that micro generation of punk where if all those people that were there heckling him in 2 years, it'd be like, "Oh no, Forgotten Rebels are great," you know. Like, but it's just those little periods where, you know, you're coming up and you're the new thing, and it doesn't relate quite to what you think is the new thing. The other thing is you can look back and like, there's songs that are like. You know, 60s punk, like garage punk, like even the Troggs, they have a song called Your Love. It's just, yeah, King, like, so there's like, and you know, of course, then the Stooges were like the most, one of the biggest links coming out in the late 60s, but it was like, there's such a long thing to it, but there's always a different slant and a new era, and yeah, like it's,
I would even
it's cool.
argue like blues and country music at one point would have been
as a punk,
thing.
Yeah.
Elvis. They were burning his records in the South, right?
Yeah.
He was the devil.
Yeah.
At one point. So I think it's going to continue going forward. I hope so, anyway.
Yeah.
You know, everyone always has something that riles them or gets under their skin. So to you, what makes a good punk song?
Catchy riffs, good lyrics, fun lyrics.
Yeah. It's got to be a bit catchy. And it's got to,
high
for
energy.
Me, yeah, high energy, ride the line between, if it gets too melodic, it starts to bug me, like, oh, okay, I get it, like, I like, right when it rides the line, and maybe if there's, like, the odd weird, I like humor,
yeah.
And, so, like, bands like Turbo Negro, and,
Cramps.
Yeah, and even, like, they're not obviously funny, but even the Misfits, like,
yeah.
I don't know, some of it's, like, it doesn't take it, I mean, it does take itself seriously, but at the same time, it's, you know, it's cartoonish and fun, and, yeah, so if there's, like, an element of fun and aggression at the end, maybe humor all happening at the same time, that's almost the best, that's my favorite, almost.
Yeah. They're all good.
Yeah.
They're all good things to throw in the blender.
Yeah.
Spit out.
Yeah.
Does what it means to be a punk today different than what it meant to be a punk 30 years ago?
I think it, yeah, there was the whole, like, people would get beat up for what they were, for that they were dressed like, and people that were, like, the next generation up for me would say, like, oh, like, in, like, 77 or 78, like, if some guy just had slightly funny sunglasses on Queen Street, he'd be like, hey, man! Like, they'd run over and, like, start talking, like, oh, okay, you're part of the scene, okay, you're part of the scene now, because there were so few, and they had to band together.
Right.
And other people, like, someone I play with in another band, I mean, the other band's The Enchanters, he's from Edmonton, and any kind of punk or, like, kind of subculture like that, it was still like that. You'd have to get in fights and stuff all the time. Toronto, that all happened because it was such a center in the 70s and early 80s. By the time I really got into it in the 80s and 90s, it was like, I think you didn't really have to worry about getting attacked for, you know, leather jackets or whatever else. But it's yeah, I mean, it's fairly safe now. I don't know.
Well, Craig's got a little bit of the generation thing on me. He's just got a few years on me where I missed that window. He did get to see Black Flag at the... What club was that?
I saw him at Larry's, and I saw them at the Party Center. Like,
I missed that window. Right. It's just my age.
Yeah.
That, I think, would have been a different time. We probably still could have got roughed up.
The feeling there was really a bit... Yeah, that was a bit on edge, that the My War...
Yeah, but like, just the scene at that time.
Yeah.
It was that early 80s, sort of a weird Toronto leaving that in the 70s, early
80s
punk scene.
Yeah.
It would have been interesting.
Well, Craig, Eric, The Exploders, thanks so much.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you.
Once again, that was Eric Duhl and Craig Daniels from the band The Exploders. You can follow them on Facebook at The Real Exploders, or visit their website, theexploders1.bandcamp.com. As listeners of the show know, I love talking about independent film, and especially when I can find one made in Canada. Luba is one such film that not only was made in Toronto, but the city becomes almost another character in the story. It grew out of an actor's co-op and workshop, meaning that all the actors who are in it are also producers. I spoke with the director of the film, Kaylee Wilson, as well as actress Brianna D'Aguano, who plays the role of Jasmine. And this film itself also had a long road. It was shot in 2016, made its festival run in 2018, and got its release in theaters on January 10th, 2020. So I talked to both Kaylee and Brianna about that process and making it an independent film like this in this city. Kaylee, directing the writer, Vlad, who played the male lead in the film. So this is my conversation with Kaylee Wilson and Brianna D'Aguano of the film Luba.
I'm here with Kaylee Wilson and Brianna D'Aguano, the director and one of the stars of the film Luba. The film had its premiere last week, and Kaylee, I'll start with you. Do you feel a sense of relief? Because I know you actually shot this thing back in, what was it, 2016?
Yeah, it's definitely been a long road. I don't know if relief is the right word. I think you kind of, with the festival run, that was another moment of excitement, and I think it sort of falls in the background, so... I think if anything, it's almost rejuvenating to have one more last kick of the can, as it were.
Brianna, how does it feel for you? You shot it 4 years ago, did the festival run, and now it's here now, and you've become a bit of a star. You're doing a lot of your own projects as well. Was it fun going back and reliving this project one more time?
Yeah, it honestly was. And well, for one, I looked like a baby because it was so long ago. And quite honestly, I forgot a lot of the scenes that we filmed, so it was really interesting to go back and watch it and be able to see everything and remember, and yeah, it was a really great film, so yeah, it was really interesting to see.
For both of you, the first time you saw the finished product on screen, what went through your heads?
Wow, I don't know, you go first, Ray.
Okay. Honestly, I was very impressed with the cinematography, first of all. The movie looked beautiful, all of it. Every shot was stunning, whether it was the city or the actors. I really think the authenticity of, the acting is what kind of shocked me the most, because, it was all great, especially Porter. He's so young. So I was really impressed with all the acting in the film, first of all, and it was just... really well put together. It was a beautiful movie,
yeah. I have to agree too. I think if anything, this maybe, I hate to say it, but maybe a bit of surprise that hey, that actually worked out really well. I remember talking to Chris Mutton, our editor, at the early stages, I mean, it was such an indie thing. We didn't have continuity people, you know, so he didn't have a lot of notes even to work with. And I remember kind of sitting there going, like, is this guy even going to be able to cut scenes together? Like, are we missing massive pieces? So I think, yeah, that was actually a huge sense of relief, seeing the whole thing put together and seeing how well it turned out.
Was this a normal audition and casting process for everybody involved? Brandon, did you just sort of audition and they're like, yeah, I think you're right for the part type of thing?
Well, Vlad was actually one of my coworkers on a movie I did a few months before Luba started filming. I know he was kind of in the process of making it or whatever. So then he contacted us and he's like, I have an idea for a role for you in this movie. Would you like to do it? So I accepted and yeah, then I started working. So I knew Vlad from beforehand.
Yeah, it definitely was not, it was a very unorthodox sort of way of putting things together. I did almost no casting. Because we shot this film through the actor co-op agreement, I don't know if a lot of people know that, but basically all the actors on the film are also producers. So in order to be a producer on the film, you're also required to play a role in the film. So a lot of the cast was put together based on Vlad and Nicole's, what is it, Monday Night Actors group that they use. So it was actually a lot of, I guess everyone sort of knew someone, mostly through Vlad and Nicole. And I believe there was actually a couple times too, or just based on the shooting schedule, it turns out that someone wasn't available and there was some rewriting and recasting going on even during production.
What was it like for you? Because Vlad also wrote the film. So for you as a director, you're also directing an actor whose words, you know, are on the page. How would you describe that experience?
There was definitely some struggles with that. Very early on, we sort of made a decision to have a sort of a voting system between Nicole, Vlad, Justin Beattie, our DP, in terms of when we came to a part where there were some creative differences, we had to have something to become a tiebreaker. So that was one of the things we did. And then we also just sort of, we all wore a lot of hats. So a big part of that was, okay, you did write this, but you're not the writer anymore. The writer's not on set. You're either the producer or you're the actor in this moment. So I'm sure it was challenging for him as well as us to sort of flip hats. But we all had to do that, or I don't think we would have, you know, gone through it.
Brianna, you alluded earlier to the performance of Porter, and I gotta say, I was a little bit blown away by him. How would each of you describe your relationship with working with an actor so young in a movie like this?
It was actually interesting. I mean, I've worked with other child actors for the majority of my life. Porter is, I don't know how old he is now. He's 11 or 12, I believe. He's going on 40.
Yeah, I think he's 12.
Is one of the oldest girls I've met. He is so smart. So, like, he never showed any immaturity on set, never threw a tantrum. One of the most professional people I've ever worked with. I bonded with him very fast. I mean, we still talk as the premiere. At the premiere, it was like no time went by. But yeah, on set, we really bonded. I was with him pretty much every time I was filming. So yeah, we got pretty close.
I mean, I have to agree with everything Brandon said regarding Porter. He's definitely a unique individual. I grew up as an actor in Toronto. I probably started acting when I was around Porter's age as well. So I sort of know what it's like to be a child surrounded by adults in that sort of working world. So, I think I'm sort of well-suited to working with actors. I'm also a father myself. And I think, you know, with kids, it's more about making a comfortable environment. And Porter and I also bonded pretty early. And rather than sort of working scenes with him, it was more about finding a moment to bond and hang out and be buddies. So that when it did come time to have a very dramatic scene, he always felt comfortable and safe. And I think that allowed him to get those performances we needed.
Brianna, how would you say you identified with your character, Jasmine?
With my character? So I was Porter's babysitter in the film. I was very assertive, and I really was pushing for Nicole to hire me. I feel like I did match with her well because this kind of is similar to my personality. when I want something, I kind of go for it and push for it. I've kind of done been like that my whole life. And in the film, as mentioned, I bonded with Porter very fast, and that kind of happened in real life too. So all that was very authentic, everything when I was with him and stuff. So I feel like, yeah, the character does reflect me pretty well. I was pretty true to myself when I was acting.
I was struck by the very naturalistic performances in the film. Kaylee, what kind of conversations went on between you and the actors in terms of the tone you wanted to set?
Well, again, it sort of goes back to that, just making things comfortable. In a lot of cases, like particularly Nicole and Vlad, I mean, they had been living this project for like a number of years before I was even brought on board. So for me, it was less about stepping in and sort of browbeating everyone around to my vision. I sort of let everyone deliver what they had already prepared, and it was more of a gentle nudging to sort of push it in the directions I felt work, as opposed to sort of trying to take control of the whole thing. So yeah, a big part of it again was just making everybody feel safe and comfortable. Yeah, just to try and get the best performances we could without trying to be too domineering.
I feel like the city of Toronto almost became a character in this film in a way as well. How much of the city did you want to showcase in this project?
Well, it's funny you say that, because we did have that discussion very early on, and we did all agree that Toronto was going to play a part. And I think for all of us who grew up in the entertainment industry, I worked both in front and behind the camera, and you've worked in so many productions where we're trying to lie and hide and disguise Toronto as itself. So for a lot of us, I think it was really exciting to be like, hey, look, we get to see a tower in the background. We can actually keep it for once. And so we did almost go out of our ways to get some of those iconic streetcar and subway shots and skyline shots. It was sort of exciting to have that freedom to just for once say, yes, this is the city we live in, and this is sort of we're not trying to hide it. Here it is.
Brianna, how did you find that as a performer, actually being able to use and reference the city that you're in and where you're shooting, as opposed to just having it be in the background?
Well, I thought it was pretty essential to the theme of the movie that it had somewhere like Toronto that it took place. So it was really good to be able to work in the city that I'm close to, of course, and kind of have the movie represent it. And what I really liked is the parts of Toronto that were shown, which was not like Dundas Square, the really nice parts. It was kind of the more run-down areas, and I feel like this kind of represented the film well, because it's showcasing Luba's life that's very imperfect, so it's kind of showing like the imperfections of the city, so I feel like that was a good mirroring between them.
Just touching on that note, I think it was, I forget who in the movie it says, but they say, oh, everyone is from somewhere else, and what I appreciated about the film was that it doesn't, you know, glorify being poor or being in poverty. Have you thought about what this film says about the diversity of a city like Toronto?
Can you reword that a little bit? I'm not sure how to answer.
Yeah, I guess I just mean, you know, because as Brianna alluded to, you're shooting in a lot of, I guess, more rundown areas of the cities and places you might not see on film as much as, you know, a Dundas Square or the CN Tower, the Eaton Center. How do you think this film reflects the true diversity of not only a city like Toronto, but perhaps Canada as a whole?
I mean, I guess it is important. I think when a lot of people think of big cities, like just what Brianna said too, you know, you think Dundas Square, the tourist destinations, and a lot of people that are not from Toronto will only see those parts of it. So, I guess it was sort of nice to show some of the other aspects of it too, and it is a big city. So, yeah, it's not going to be perfect, and there are some undesirable areas, and there are a lot of people struggling to make things work next to people that seem to have it all together. I guess it was an interesting dichotomy, as opposed to a lot of cities or films where you feature a city, it's always, you know, the beautiful parts of the city. It was interesting to be able to show all aspects of Toronto.
Jasmine seems like she's one of the most, perhaps, together characters in the movie. Brianna, what do you think of the fact that you're one of the youngest characters and you're probably the most headstrong in the film?
Well, I think it also reflects a lot about the lives of the characters, because as seen, Maddie, Luba, and Vlad, I forget his name in the film.
Donnie.
They all struggled with pretty harsh lives, and that obviously comes across. Me and my father in the film, per se, we weren't as bad off, so I feel like it's also the environment that I grew up in kind of gave me more confidence and assertiveness in the film, and that kind of reflected in my character. So I think it's really about the environment that I grew up in and was exposed to. It wasn't the same one that Maddie, per se, was exposed to, and I didn't have the struggles that Luba had to deal with. So I feel like that kind of played into the headstrong aspect of the character.
Kaylee, do you think this film says anything about surviving in the economy we are today? There are so many discussions about, you know, millennials trying to do this and you know, high prices in this city. Does this film comment on that, do you think, in any way?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that was a big part of Luba's struggle and trying to show, you know, how difficult it can be. It's not just the homeless people on the streets that struggle to make ends meet. It's also people who work two jobs, but still struggle to make things work. The city's definitely an expensive place to work, and it sort of goes to show that you need family and support and other people to help things work. I don't think a lot of people are able to survive on a single income anymore. I think that was sort of something we were trying to say too, you know, how difficult it is to break those cycles. That was one of the things we tried to show with Luba. There's not, you know, obviously Vlad's not the nicest character, but he's also not your typical horrible villain. He's just a man who made some bad choices. And same thing with, you know, Luba. She got to this position not because she was horrible or deserved it. It's just sort of the way life goes sometimes. And once you're living in that position, it's very difficult to get out of that.
On that note, then, what does this film and these characters say about family? Family is good no matter how dysfunctional it is?
I don't know if I would use that quote exactly. I mean, family will be part of your lives whether it's good or bad, and that's something you have to deal with it. I think sometimes it's easy to have your blinders on with family. I think that was an important thing. You know, Donnie and his mother's relationship, she sort of couldn't see any of the bad because that was her son and that was family. But also the bond between Donnie and Maddie, you know, Porter played this young kid who still couldn't understand why his father was, you know, a negative influence in his life because it was his father. I mean, I like to think most families are far more functional than this one. But I think, yeah, family are with you one way or the other, for good or for bad. We just hope that for most times it's a little more functional.
The film does end on a happier note. Brianna, do you think that Jasmine, you know, once the cameras have stopped rolling, is she going to continue to be a part of that family?
Yeah, I would assume so. I mean, as I mentioned, she had built a really strong connection with not only Maddie, but Luba. I think she really felt for them, and she kind of understood their struggles, which meaning that she would go in whenever Luba needed her, be there for Maddie. So I feel like she has a connection with that family now, not only on a babysitter level, but also a personal level. She really cares for them. So yeah, if I had to say if she was going to be in their lives for longer, I'd say yes, especially since her and Jasmine's father, Luba and Jasmine's father, have a stronger relationship now. They know each other. So yeah, I feel like she would stay in their lives.
Kaylee, have you thought about what happens or happened to these characters once the film ended?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of that went into the sort of end montage of the movie. We were sort of trying to say, this is how they're moving forward. And it was we were careful. We didn't want to say that Donnie ever got replaced, but we were sort of alluding to the idea that Luba and Maddie were working on building a healthier family environment, and whether that, you know, remains platonic or whatever else, I do feel that those four characters are going to be in each other's lives, certainly for the next little bit. Particularly when you go through an experience like that, it tends to bond people pretty hard. So yeah, I think definitely they're going to look out for each other in the foreseeable future.
What does Luba tell us about love? I know Donnie has some pretty interesting things to say there at the end of the film.
I'm not sure there's a clear picture there. I mean, I think love can come in many forms. I think different people have different definitions of love, and I think love is different for everybody. I think Luba tried to explore a bunch of different aspects. You know, there's the love between a father and a child, child and his parents. Then there's also, of course, romantic love. And then there's the mistaken love, perhaps, of our youth, too. And I think, you know, Luba sort of tried to explore all those different avenues. Don't know if we did it successfully, but I think we were definitely experimenting there.
We talked about the ending a little bit. Do you feel like there's hope? Not only for these characters, but for perhaps people living in similar circumstances in real life?
Absolutely, and I really feel that was a message we were trying to show. You know, sometimes that hope requires you breaking your bonds and moving forward. There is definitely a cyclical nature with addiction and even amongst relationships with addicted people that I think sometimes need to be broken to move on, you know. It's not as if no one can be cured from that, but more often than not, it's something dramatic like this that is required to break a cycle and help someone such as Luba to move on, get herself a better job, a better apartment, and move forward with her life and help raise her son in the way that she always felt he deserved to be raised.
You talked about, you know, shooting this in conjunction with the Actors Co-op. Where do you think we're at in the Canadian film industry these days?
Where do you think we're... I'm sorry, I don't understand.
I guess, like, you know, because... it's hard to get a film made, period, but specifically in Canada, it can be a lot harder to get the momentum and the coverage that perhaps Hollywood does. In terms of being a filmmaker, making a film in this country, how do you find that culture and that industry as a whole?
I feel that, you know, Canada does its best to be supportive. I do believe the Canadian film has sort of remain and will remain in a lower budget sort of area for the foreseeable future unless something dramatically changes. Ultimately, there's just not the same population and the same money, so I don't think it's fair that we will ever be able to compete with, say, the U.S., There's just much different markets. But I do think, you know, a film like Luba certainly wouldn't have been possible without the assistance of the Actor Co-op Agreement and everyone else's dedication. It's unfortunate that so many people had to volunteer to make a film. It would be lovely to have all made a fortune doing what we love. But I think that's true in independent film anywhere in the world. And Canada can be more supportive than other countries. I just think, yeah, we are sort of slightly hamstrung by our population and our limited finances.
Brianna, what...
in terms of our ability to, on the international stage.
Brianna, what do you like most about working in the industry and working in the industry in Canada?
Well, I feel like Toronto is a very strong place for acting, of course. There's many talented actresses and actors who live in Canada, Toronto especially, it's pretty well known for that. I feel like I've made a lot of personal connections with people working in the industry, and it's taught me a lot of emotional intelligence and great social skills. Having done it since I was young, I feel like I've learned a lot about having confidence and expressing myself and not really needing validation when it comes to the fact that sometimes I'll think I do great in an audition and it doesn't go the way I want it to. I won't get a call back. I won't book the role. And it kind of teaches you that life isn't always going to hand you things, and hard work does go a long way, but sometimes you're just not right for things, and you just have to accept that and accept yourself for it. So I feel like, yeah, it's taught me a lot of great lessons about who I am and what I want to do with my future and the person I want to be.
Speaking of your projects, what can we expect from in season 4 of PJ Masks?
It's a great season, honestly. Yeah, I'm still doing records for it. We're still working on it. There's new characters introduced relating to my role, the roles around me. There's been some new actors hired to play roles. There's been some replacements, but yeah, I feel like it's really great. The show is very popular now all across the world. So, yeah, they're bringing in new characters. It's going really well. It's a great season.
And Kaylee, I just wanted to mention, I know the film ends with a dedication to the actor Sam Moses, who played Dr. Zneimer in the film, who unfortunately passed away shortly after filming was done. What was your favorite memory about working with him?
I mean, when we actually shot in his house, in his apartment, that's the kitchen in the opening scene of the movie. It was also one of the first couple days we shot. And I just remember, you know, they opened their doors to us. He was such a warm, kind man. And at that stage, we hadn't acted. We were just using his location. And he sort of just hung out with us. So I barely briefly met him. But then, yeah, just that doctor scene, you know, with him and Maddie were in there. There was actually quite a bit more dialogue that we ended up having to cut just for a running time thing. But running that scene with him, there was something about him that just almost reminded me of Robin Williams in Good Will Hunting or something. He was just a lovely man. It was a wonderful experience to get to work with him. And yeah, it was very sad to lose him during this production.
I'm just curious because, you know, his name was Sam Moses and his character was Dr. Zneimer. So was that sort of a play on Moses Zneimer, who I know is a big man here in the Toronto television industry?
Yeah, it's funny. I don't think it really was. I remember bringing that up with Vlad at one point, too, and I don't think he'd actually put two and two together. I think it literally was just the way it had been written. Because, again, as we were casting the sort of unorthodox style of casting, I'm not sure even at the time of the script we knew who was going to play who, you know what I mean?
Well,
I think, yeah, that was just a coincidence.
The film is Luba, and it's in theaters now. I really enjoyed the film. Kaylee Wilson, Brianna Daguano, thanks so much for your time this evening.
Thank you so much.
All right, have a good night. Cheers.
You too.
All right, take care, man.
That was Kaylee Wilson and Brianna Daguano, the director and one of the stars of the new Canadian drama Luba, which had its release here in Toronto last week on January 10th. In addition, it is also streaming now on Highball TV. You can go to highballtv.com, and Luba is spelled L-U-B-A. My final guests are a cover band that has been described as Winefield Choir Punks, although they quickly told me that was incorrect, and they're actually Vodkafield Choir Punks. They are the Happy Hour Choir, and it was started by local punk music PR publicist Melanie Kay, who, full disclosure, is a friend of mine. They are a group of seven women who are a choir, but cover largely punk songs. They do some other stuff as well, but that is their main sort of area. And they also were on the same bill as the Exploders were a few days ago. So I got to speak with them as well about the project and what this and a sense of community means to them. Here is Happy Hour Choir.
I'm here with Happy Hour Choir.
Hey!
Hi! Woo! Hello! Yes!
So happy.
Right? Yeah. It was described on Facebook as wine-fueled choir punks.
That's fake news. Yeah. We are vodka fueled.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
We'll have wine if there's an upgrade.
Yeah. I mean, if we can't get the vodka.
Yeah. Is performing on vodka different than performing on wine?
It's more.
Yeah. Oh yeah, it's
more loose.
Wine is so drying.
Yeah, yeah.
That's true. Why?
Yeah. Yeah. Vodka's a better lubricant.
For sure. For the throat.
Let's just clarify.
Never mind.
It's soothing ointment for the throat. Yeah. Right.
Yes. Yeah.
It's our
lubrication is key. That's what
we're
saying.
To be key.
Yeah. Melanie, I know you were the one that sort of put this group together.
Debbie. Yeah.
Everyone is all running around. Nobody knows what's happening. Yeah. But Melanie, where did the idea for this group come from? I know you've been involved in punk rock PR for many years.
Mm-hmm. Well, I sang in a bunch of bands over the years, and I have always loved singing, and I decided that I needed to actively do something to make sure that I was contributing to the level of joy that was in my life, and singing has always contributed to that. And so, I saw Mavis Staples perform with her amazing voice, and she was singing with this 100-piece choir in Dallas, and so that was sort of an inspiration, but I didn't want to make it a religious lyrical right. thing, so I initially thought I would join a choir, but then I realized I needed to start a choir because I didn't want to sing about God per se. And so, or that kind of God, you know? And, so basically I put it out there, and people in my neighborhood responded, and, you know, my girlfriends said, yeah, we want to do this too. So that's how it started.
For you all, you talked about...
And my boyfriend. so we've got Neil playing guitar, yeah. and Chuck Coles is joining us tonight. But people were receptive to the idea, so that's how it got going.
You mentioned you didn't want to sing about God, but for everybody here, who would you say are the gods of punk rock?
Oh, I don't believe in that either.
No?
She's a punk rock atheist.
Fair. I mean, that makes sense.
No, putting people on a pedestal, I think, is not how I personally would want to roll.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's, you know, when you think of choir, you think of chamber and classical. Mm-hmm. How would you describe punk choral music?
Campfire.
Campfire. Yeah. Like singing around a campfire.
Campfire.
Yes.
It's like singing around a campfire.
Everybody sings to the best of their abilities. There's no real.
It's very diplomatic, Neil.
Right.
Yes. Except for our pitch, bitch.
Yeah, we've got a couple secret weapons, but we don't take it too seriously. But we take it seriously enough that we rehearse once a week,
right?
And we try to sound like Neil said as best as we can.
And change up our repertoire.
Too. Yeah.
The choir, as I'm sitting here, we got a lovely bunch of women.
Thank you.
And Neil.
Yes.
And Chuck.
But was...
We're inclusive.
Yes. But was that an important aspect for you, you know, punk rock females?
Yes, absolutely. And for me, it's part of the whole joy aspect is I love hanging out with women, and I need to do that. And it's therapeutic, and it's what, yeah, my heart actually needs. So
I find it therapeutic.
Yeah.
So, yeah, group therapy.
Most of the bands that I've gravitated towards playing or promoting, there's women involved on some level.
Yeah.
So I don't want it to be whatever I'm doing, you know, that expression, the sausage party. Try to avoid that.
For the rest of you, what did you?
I'm really sick. So responses are really ridiculous.
And so like, no. Like I said, Melanie's used to getting me the interviews, not being the
subject. And now you know why.
not being the subject of one. Yeah. So, yeah. But for the rest of you, what was the appeal of this type of group?
Community.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah.
One of the strongest things, and the convenience with the community, because we get together close to home, it's no pressure, we're a lovely bunch, we all have a pretty good jam together, and...
we've known each other for a long time.
Yeah, we go back.
It's just as fun. You can have the shittiest day, and then you're like, oh, I don't know if I want to go to rehearsal, and then you go, it's like, oh my God, that was awesome.
So, yeah.
We all work long hours. We have kids. We have busy lives. It's, it's really nice to tap into that creative part of your soul once in a while.
Yeah.
Once a week for one happy hour.
One happy hour. But then you feed off of that for
And when we nail it, we know we nail it. And when we don't nail it, we also all intuitively know we didn't nail it.
Or Neil tells us.
Or I stop.
Sometimes Neil just winces in pain and we're like, okay, we should do that one again.
But he's always very positive.
What makes a good show or performance for you?
Vodka. Remember the vodka?
Yeah.
If we remember all the words, that's vodka. Key.
Yeah. Oh, and giant font of the.
Yes.
That helps for sure.
When we all start at the same time, that's good.
That's good. It helps us a lot if the audience is really drunk.
Yeah.
That's good. That's always good for us.
Just a party atmosphere.
Yeah. I just like to have fun.
Loose.
Do you
do your own arranging of the songs, or do you find stuff that's already pre-done?
We do our own.
We do.
What's that process like for you in terms of putting that together? Is that a Neil question?
Yeah.
Well, usually these guys will suggest a bunch of songs, and some of them we try once or twice and go, that's not really working. And then other ones, they just come together naturally, really. I mean, you never end up playing the whole song, just because of the nature of the way we do it. We tend to cut out, like, instrumental parts and stuff like that. But usually we follow the arrangement of the original song to, like, you know, most of the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And sometimes
I try to throw in some harmony here or there, wherever I can.
Yeah.
I try to copy her. Yeah.
Get choir-like.
We have a happy approach with the choir to each song.
Right.
That's the ultimate goal.
Yeah.
If it doesn't make us happy and bring joy, then it usually gets nixed.
Yeah. Some songs fit right away, and then other ones, you know, take a little bit of work to get them to work, and then other ones just right from the get-go, you know, they're not going to work. So.
I think more so than other music communities, the punk scene is very tight and very close knit. What do you make of the punk scene today? Is it different than maybe 20, 30 years ago?
I don't think so. I don't personally. I think that it's always evolving, and you know, that there's different groups, but there's, you know, Janice used the word community, and that the community vibe, at least for me, it's whatever you put into it is usually what you get out of it, right? I don't know. What do you guys think?
I think that was well said.
Thank you. Thank you, Talon.
I when I think of venues in Toronto, Bovine is where I go when I, you know, think of louder sort of punk based music. Why is this type of venue made for this type of genre? Does that make sense?
Like, how does this fit with a punk lineup?
Yeah, like what is it about this space that's inducive to like a louder sound as opposed to something like the Horseshoe, which is a great venue but has, you know, maybe a folk band or solo acoustic artists.
Is it proudly self claimed as a dive bar? So I think that there's that whole like tongue in cheek kind of thing as well. So there's that DIY. Sort of vibe.
Comes back to campfire.
Yeah.
Community, campfire.
Yeah.
Happy, joy.
Yeah.
Vodka.
But one doesn't tolerate judgment, though.
Right.
That's a lot of places. It's a safe place for a lot of people that are outsiders from different places, you know what I mean? So like, it's a place where people feel comfortable to be themselves.
That's a
good point.
Yeah.
Inclusive.
Well, Chuck does open mic every Monday here.
Okay.
And so his thing, you know, is to invite people to come and do whatever they want to do. And not a lot of places, I can't actually think of anywhere really that does that.
Yeah, you try to cater to everybody, but it's hard to get up there and do this kind of stuff. Like, even when you guys are doing it, it's hard to do that, you know? But if you have it's like a support group. Everyone's there for the same reason and like, helping each other out, you know?
Yeah.
So if you keep doing that, it just brings like a good vibe to the place, you know?
Mm-hmm.
We've talked about campfires and vodka. So, do you all have a favorite campfire song?
Fuck you,
by Lilia.
Yeah,
true. That's a good one.
Yeah,
that's a good one.
My family went camping every year for summer as our family vacation, and we always used to sing Waylon Jennings songs. So I associate campfire songs with Waylon Jennings.
Right.
That's fair.
That's a thing.
Yeah. And finally, vodka straight or in a mixed drink?
Yes.
Soda.
Yes.
Around the table, vodka. Round of vodka sodas for everybody.
Pretty much.
Happy Hour Choir. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
That was my conversation with Happy Hour Choir. That does it for me today. Next week on my two shows, I'll have actress Hazel Dupe, as well as Mike Reno from legendary Canadian band Leverboy. Be sure to tune in for those. I'll see you next time. Thanks for listening. Bye for now.
Artists like to have a lot of sex.